welcome to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. This is a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after. I'm Michelle Boyce, and Deb Elhamza will be with us shortly. And today we are talking about the ever-controversial topic of parent alienation. And on the phone, I have Mike Murphy, who is kind of an advocate on the subject that has been working on this for years. Mike, you there?
I'm here.
Awesome. Wonderful. So Mike is a political advocate for change to family law and bringing greater awareness to parent alienation, member of Fathers for Justice, director for the Canadian Equal Parenting Council, and a whole bunch of other stuff. So thanks for joining us, Mike.
Glad to be here.
Just to give our listeners a little bit of, an intro to parent alienation, I've got probably the best-known psychologist, Michael Jones, who is going to intro this for us.
Parental alienation is a phrase that refers to the behaviors of a parent. When parents are going through divorce, they're supposed to encourage a positive relationship between the child and the other parent. But in the context of divorce, that sometimes is rather difficult because there is a divorce going on after all. But when the behaviors are severe in the sense of a parent talking very negatively about the other parent in earshot of the child, then we can begin to see that that's moving in the direction of parental alienation. The behaviors engaged in by that parent can be behaviors such as frank criticism of the other parent. I've heard of parents telling the child that the other parent didn't want them to be born, that they wanted to have an abortion, and all kinds of things that are grossly inappropriate for children to really come to believe. What we're talking about with parental alienation is a long-term, sustained campaign of this over a period of time, although it frankly doesn't take that much time if the campaign's pretty intense. These four criteria, it's important to understand, really create a fact pattern. It's something that you can look through a history of a case and see chronologically these things happen. You'll see a separation happen, and then there'll be some problem where there's less visitation, that one parent will want the child to be with the other parent for all kinds of reasons. But you'll see it take on a pattern of intensity that develops just as we described earlier. So when this environment is present for a period of time, the child begins to develop behaviors or symptoms that have been referred to as parental alienation syndrome. And that term is a term that was coined by a psychiatrist by the name of Richard Gardner, who died a number of years ago. But he first described this in 1985, where he began to notice this strange phenomenon where these children began to elicit these behaviors that were really unusual for children of divorce. So he was the first really to articulate these eight behavioral manifestations or symptoms that these children will demonstrate. And they demonstrate them more symptoms the longer it's progressed. Like with any pathological condition, it's easier to diagnose when it's more progressed and more difficult when in the early stages. But it's, I think, been pretty effectively shown that these eight behavioral manifestations, or what he referred to as symptoms, are pretty reliable. There's recently been some research done on adults who, as children, had been alienated, and there was research done on the validity of these eight criteria or symptoms, and the principal author of that work really felt like the eight criteria were very accurate.
I have a child that I haven't seen for half of his life. You know, I don't know him. I don't know what he likes. I don't know what he does. It is. It's like death. Yeah, but worse. I don't often talk about it. I don't talk about it with anybody except for my closest friends and family. There aren't any sympathy cards. There aren't any. Nobody brings you a casserole, you know, and says, you know. It's just, you're basically, you're alone, feel alienated.
And we're back. So that gives you an idea of what we're talking about. And Mike, maybe you can tell the audience a little bit about you.
Well, I'd add a little bit more to what the good doctor said. It's not necessarily something that arises just during divorce and separation, although that's where the preponderance of the cases will arise. I have also seen situations where parents weren't getting along during a marriage, and the children were being recruited by one parent to hate the other parent. And that is a prelude, of course, to custody. In other words, if the one parent has recruited the children prior to the divorce or separation to side with them, then that makes their case for custody a tad easier with the courts, because they already have the children on side.
Yeah, these cases are rather traumatic, and I know you've been through this yourself, and I mean, I've been through it myself as well with my custody access case. So it's a topic that's extremely close to my heart as well. Deb's with us here.
Hi, Mike.
Hi.
So Deb actually works with CAS in her real job. So she's got a lot of experience as well with parent alienation. So, Mike, can you tell us a little bit about your story that brought you to advocacy?
Well, it certainly involved, in part, the parent alienation of my children from me. And this occurred throughout the process of the family breaking down. And it can come as quite a shock, you know, because you don't know where it came from or why it came at the time, because all of this can go on in the background. You can be living in the same household together with your children, and most of the time you're going through your normal daily activities with the children, and nothing is registering other than perhaps on some days they appear grumpier than usual and that sort of thing. And that can progress. Now, interesting for me, I was the stay-at-home parent. I was the dad who was with them 24/7 for 10 years, so I should have been on top of this. And that's how surprising and shocking it can be, because I was with them most of the time. And it manifests itself in many different ways. As I said, grumpiness may start occurring, and then later on a little bit of belligerence. And you can see in the children, they're going through some degree of emotional pain, because suddenly, without any apparent reason, and I say apparent reason because there's clearly, if children are being abused by the parent, then they have very good reason to oppose that parent and to denigrate that parent and to not like that parent and to want to avoid that parent. So if you take away this abuse thing and get it out of the way, and no abuse is occurring, and this behavior is going on by the children, then you're taken aback by it, because you can sit and chat with them, but the children are quite reluctant to talk to you about it directly. They're torn. They don't want to appear to be going behind the back of the recruiting parent, the parent who's trying to alienate them. And so it puts them on the spot. It puts them in a more difficult position, because now they're being confronted in a manner of speaking, although it's in a more comfortable setting. There's no attacking going on here, verbal attacking or anything. It's just quiet questioning. But they're still in a problematic way. So for me, what occurred was just downright shocking, because one day, both children, out of the blue, we went out to a restaurant, and they both started tearing me apart in the restaurant. They called me every name in the book, and they said they really didn't want to be with me, and anything that could be hurtful. And some of the things that came out of their mouths could not have originated with them. They were children. They were young children. And so you got to thinking, in fact, not thinking, you've heard your ex say those very things to you that they're now repeating, and you know that she did not necessarily say them in front of the children, So they had to have found out directly from her. And it can range from a whole host of things. You're fat, you're lazy, you're overweight, you've got yellow teeth, you're bald, anything that would be considered a personal insult. And I was floored. I just couldn't believe what I was hearing from my two children, who I had raised. And we had a loving relationship. So I did a little research on it and found out that, in fact, people like back in those days, and this was a while back, Alec Baldwin had also come up with his own personal situation that involved the alienation of his daughter. And so I continued my research, and I determined for myself that that's the kind of thing that was going on. And it certainly fit the pattern of behavior that I had observed from my ex, and that in order to gain custody of the children, she would have to actually recruit them. And her job was even more difficult because, in my case, I was a stay-at-home parent, so I was the closest to them both physically and emotionally for all of their lives to that point. So that's how it came to be with me. And it's not dissimilar with other parents as well. And one of the things in my research that hit home heavily is a case that occurred in Canada in 1991. And this was long before parental alienation in and of itself had become a term that anybody understood in Canada. And Justice John Gomery, you may remember him from the ADSCAM inquiry in Canada. He was the chair of that investigation. He was also a family court judge in Quebec. And he said in this case in 1991, where the father had alienated the children from the mother, that hatred is not an emotion that comes naturally to a child. It has to be taught. A parent who would teach a child to hate the other parent represents a grave and persistent danger to the mental and emotional health of the child. And that comment and statement that he made when I went through the court case, and through my research, I also met the mom in that case as well, three years ago now, who's still very active, but in the United States, in Texas, working with alienated children. It just resonated with me and stayed with me. And here was the situation in 1991 in the Superior Court of Canada in Quebec, where this very event occurred and was well-researched. And Judge Gomery gave Mom custody back, which he had lost, but that one of the children, at least one of the children, was so alienated that it was almost impossible for him to reconnect with his mom at that time. So that was a very tragic case, but there are so many of them that we read about now, and it's much more common to see that in Canadian and American courts.
Yes, and that's for sure. I mean, I'm in a similar situation with you, that I was the full-time parent prior to the beginning of the alienation. So similar to you, my ex had a bigger battle in there with my kids, but it still took me 8 years of some pretty dramatic influx. I mean, the bits were that I was a liar and I was dishonest and that I couldn't be trusted, and they had to keep their stuff, their toys, from me because they would get broken or lost, or, you know, that was the game that was played with me. So I had to take a stance where since 2000 I have not told a lie, and everybody in my life knows that I have never told a lie, which means that I am one of the most honest people that you will ever meet. And I had to take that extreme, and so that my children absolutely knew that every word that came out of my mouth had no lies attached to it. So, I mean, some of the stuff that we as parents have to go through when we have the alienated parent or alienating parent attacking us is pretty dramatic.
And it's very dramatic.
Well, it is indeed. They're basically using the children as a proxy to get get you. And one can only imagine the emotional pain and trauma that child eventually, if not at the time, eventually is going to suffer. And you alluded earlier to adults who have gone through alienation and what has become of them. And Amy Baker, a psychologist in the Eastern U.S., has done a book on that. And the adults who were alienated later in life had all kinds of emotional complications as a result of that alienation, even though they may have felt a solid bond at the time with the parent who was recruiting them against a target parent.
Exactly. And actually, we have a clip from one of those parents, Natalie. She's in a similar situation, except the pain for her got too much. And this is her story in our This Is Me section.
Me.
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 This is what it's like
to be me.
To be me.
This is what it's like to be me.
This is Natalie Murray. I am living in Trenton, Ontario, where I am a military electronics technician and have been for 24 years. I have two little girls. They are 11 and 14. I haven't seen them since March of 2009. The last visit I had, everything seemed to go all right. I had them down here, celebrated yet another Christmas with them 3 months late, and we have a little bash with Christmas and birthday presents. And then I took them back up to Ottawa, and everything seemed to go all right then. But when I went to arrange, I was supposed to have them the long weekend in May of 2009. When I went to arrange that, my elder daughter said that, well, I have this birthday party to go to. Okay, that's fine and dandy. That's one day out of the three. You can have the Saturday. I'll come and get you on Saturday evening. We'll come back here and we'll still have a good time. Oh, and by the way, out of the other 2 days, we want to spend one day with our mom and one day with you. And that was kind of the straw for me that broke the camel's back. So in other words, I'd kind of gone from having them for three straight days to maybe an overnight right in the middle. And it just made me feel like I really, really didn't matter. And that was when I told them, look, if I'm not a priority to you girls, call me when you figure that you want me in your life. As far as I'm concerned, by disconnecting with them, I did what I had to do to protect my own well-being. Because banging my head against the wall again and again, trying to chase after their affections when the message they kept sending over and over again was that I was not a priority to them. It was causing me a lot of mental distress, and it wasn't helping on top of some of the other stuff I was dealing with, just with the whole transition thing. One of the last things I actually did hear from them, which would have been around August of 2009, were verbatim, leave me alone, from each one of them. As far as I'm concerned, my ex has managed to persuade them to be ashamed of me. She said, your access to the kids is not my problem anymore. It means that if I am to get anywhere with the kids, I have to do it on my own, and she's not going to help. But what I'm very sure that she is going to do is she's going to undo any efforts that I have. We had a number of instances, my partner and myself, when we went to Ottawa to try and pick them up. Getting there and getting quite literally to the outskirts of town, phoning them, letting them know we'd be there within about half an hour to an hour. And finding out, oh, they're not coming. She used to say that, oh, I'm trying to ensure that they have a good relationship with you. But I think her actions are speaking far louder than those words. I think those words are quite empty. It is very difficult, and it's... some of this is actually quite difficult to put into proper words without getting angry, without letting the tears come through. I say, Heather and Shannon, I love you, I miss you, and I want you in my life, no matter what anybody else tells you.
Welcome back. Our guest today is Mike Murphy, from the Director for the Canadian Equal Parenting Council. This is a very serious issue we're talking about today, parental alienation. This is very damaging to children. Now, Mike, you were saying that when this happened to you, you were in a restaurant with your children. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened after that and how long this went on?
Well, it shocked me greatly because the children before this had never, other than being grumpy, had never done this, especially in combination. Both of them were a team. They were in unison in terms of what they had planned. This was pre-planned. They had pre-planned it, and they knew that they were going to want to make it a negative occasion, and they were going to insult me. And there's two really big factors that that I made observation of at the time while this was going on. One is they had no guilt, no fear, and they didn't care that other people in the restaurant could hear them. And those two behaviors right there were, I found later, I didn't know it at the time, were pretty symptomatic of a child who had been recruited into a parental alienation kind of situation where they would do that to a former loving parent and do it without any apparent remorse or guilt. And so that spurred me on to do more research. And I did, and funny enough, I did consult with the local Children's Aid Society after that to see if they could assist me in determining why this behavior might be occurring. And they weren't of any help in that respect, because what they told me, at least the local chamber here in, or Children's Aid Society here in Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, at that time, had no experience with alienated children. They had told me that they can deal with physical abuse, but they can't, at that time, they couldn't deal with emotional abuse. Now, I don't know if they can now at this point in time. That may have changed since that. That was quite a number of years ago. So I did consult with them, and that proved to be not useful for me at the time. And so I mulled over what I had heard. I still couldn't figure it out, what was causing this, why was it being done, because we were still living together as a family at that point. So I didn't really get a clear grasp of it until I came across some of Alec Baldwin's musings about his situation, where he said pretty much the same thing. His daughter would continually insult him. And that's when I learned that about the term parental alienation, and that's when I started digging into it a lot more than I had before. And when I did do the research and I started looking up what kinds of things were going on, it fit. It certainly fit a pattern. There was no abuse by me to the children. I had been their stay-at-home parent for 10 years since their infancy up until that point. And so I could rule out both physical abuse and emotional abuse as reasons for them turning on me like this. The only other conclusion I could come to was that because of what they had said, and that those kinds of things were said by their mother before, was that their mother had recruited them to be on her side for, excuse me, a future custody battle.
Yeah, Mike, when you're going through this, did you ever think about walking away?
Oh, yes. During the battles that occurred, these are the legal battles that occurred later on, you get, because put this in terms of you're a parent, especially if you're the stay-at-home parent, whether you're male or female, you're the stay-at-home parent, and you've raised these children, you've been their caregiver for, in my case, 10 years straight, hardly ever away from them. I was available 24/7. I worked from home at the time, so the only time I was away from them was, I think, a couple of weekends in that 10-year period. So what is happening here is that your heart has been torn out. And I think it was the Game of Thrones that I was watching a week or two ago, where one of the actors said, the pain that I felt, the emotional pain I felt, was like somebody had torn my heart out of my chest. And then the process of trying to stop the alienation, was like someone constantly squeezing the heart in front of your face. The emotional pain is something that only a parent who's lost a child through death would understand.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
Exactly, and that's what you hear a lot about is how parent alienation and being the target of that feels like you've actually lost a child. And actually, Dr. Bones has just a this short clip that's 1 minute long that I think everybody needs to hear about that making waves and how that goes into and plays into this, and how, like you went to the Children's Aid, and like many of us that have reached out for help, we don't get the help that we need.
One of the things that happens in these kinds of cases, and questions that I get all the time, are people wondering if that's what's happening in their lives. They'll be going through a divorce, or perhaps they've been divorced, and now suddenly things have changed for whatever reason, and their child or children are no longer as willing to see them and that sort of thing. And that's often at that level. The questions that you often hear are, what should I do? I mean, should I insist on seeing them? Because if I do, it sort of puts the children in the middle and it makes it more difficult for them. Or should I sort of, oh, that's okay, if you don't want me to come to your basketball game because it'll upset you, then okay, I won't, because I don't want to make waves. What I have found is that most of the advice, I'm certain well-intended, most of the advice by oftentimes mental health professionals as well as by attorneys is, don't make waves. If the child doesn't want to have you there, or if there's some sort of reason to believe you shouldn't be there because of the child's wishes or that other parent's wishes, then don't make waves. In these kinds of cases, that's the wrong advice. That's the beginning of things eroding and finally losing a relationship with the children.
How about that, Mike? Did you ever get that advice?
Oh, yes, indeed. Dr. Bowen is quite right. In fact, the Children's Aid Society here in the Sioux gave me that advice. Basically, don't rock the boat, because it's going to upset the children. And so, yes, you'll certainly get a lot of advice like that. And given my close relationship to the children and my deep and abiding love for them, I thought if I had backed off, they might see down the road someday that I had actually walked out of their lives. I had given up and I didn't love them, and everything their other parent had said was true. And so I said to myself, there's nothing more important to me in my life than my children, who I had been with 10 years and had a close relationship with. So what I was going to do, I was not going to take their advice. I was going to fight it every step of the way. And so I did. I started blogging. I became one of the first Canadian bloggers on parental alienation. And it became a bit of a worldwide phenomenon, because there wasn't that many people going public with their own personal situation in those days. And so what it did was it created greater awareness of the situation of parental alienation for others who might be like me, been going through this sort of thing but didn't know what the heck was going on. And so that was my first step, blogging it, making it public. And I didn't let my my ex know, or she wasn't then my ex, but she would be, that I was doing this at that point in time. It wasn't meant as a revenge thing. It was meant for, one, therapy for me, and two, to bring greater awareness of what was going on. The other thing that I did was, I wasn't going to take any guff from her in terms of gatekeeping. In other words, one of the big things that that occurs with alienating a child is the parent who has the children will gatekeep. They will keep the children from you as much as they can. So on the first visit I had for access to the children after the separation, she claimed they weren't feeling well. Well, I had raised them for 10 years, and I was with them all of the time they were ill, so I was quite capable of taking care of them if they were ill. So that didn't wash with me. So what I did was, even though I knew I didn't have a hope and heck of chance of having anything come to fruition on it, I called the police. and I had the police attend at her house. And yes, it was traumatic for the children because there were the police in the house and asking why they didn't want to go with their father. And so there's certain risks involved in this, both with the children's emotions and it could backfire. But I did it. And I wanted to set a bar, and I wanted to set the bar so that I'm not going to take this. I know exactly what's going on, and I'm not going to allow it to occur without you seeing me fight for my children.
And they saw that,
so,
right, Mike?
I did it on a one-time-only basis. I said I'd never do it again, and I never did. But she knew right away, first time she tried gatekeeping, I was not going to stand for it. And so I think it was important to establish the ground in those early days when the children were taken from me so that my ex knew clearly that this wasn't going to be a piece of cake for her, that she couldn't do this without impunity.
Perfect. Well, Mike, we've got to go to a short commercial break, and then we'll be back on Between the Margins.
We are all in this together, brothers and sisters. We can
and welcome back to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. I'm Michelle Boyce.
I'm Devil Hamza.
And on the phone with us is Mike Murphy, and coming up is Brian Ludmer, who is probably one of the best lawyers in Toronto on these alienation cases. I hear you're familiar with Brian, Mike.
Oh, yes. Brian is a dynamo. He was, an incredibly articulate spokesperson from the legal community. And I have to tell you, there aren't that many of them out there in dealing with parental alienation. And he knows exactly what's going on because he experienced it himself. So you didn't have to try and convince him of your story so much because he already knew through his own life what can happen between a parent and his children.
Perfect. Well, we're going to listen to Brian now and give us the legal aspects of some of this parent alienation stuff.
Hi, Brian Ludmer. I'm a lawyer with 24 years of experience. I have a combined practice of business, securities, and high conflict family law. Let me just focus on the human rights aspect of it. In Canada, we actually don't have as a fundamental human right the right to parent. Our Supreme Court of Canada said that access is the right of the child, and that creates all kinds of issues. In the United States, they actually have, as part of their Bill of Rights, as part of the fundamental life, liberty, and security of the person, or perhaps one of their amendments, the right to parent as a fundamental human right. So that there's a substantial difference in approach. Practically speaking, not certain whether at the end of the day there's a huge difference in outcome, but the discourse is important because there are some cases where the singular focus on the child could lead to an absurd result where you say, well, this child's too far gone, or there's just too much anxiety in trying to reconcile the child, and we should just give up to save the child that anxiety. And of course, if you factored into the mix the right of a parent who'd raised the child to the point prior to the divorce to continue to have a relationship and parent that child, that would make that argument much harder to make. But we do occasionally get the misguided decision in Canada that just says, you know, we should just give up to save the child the stress of being caught in the middle. And, of course, the more insightful decisions focus on the long-term benefit to the child of maintaining a healthy relationship with both parents as opposed to the short-term anxiety of breaking the fundamental family dynamic that led to the estrangement, and they say the long-term needs of the child trump any short-term issue of save the child from any stress. So it's an area in a state of flux, but in terms of human rights, that's how that discourse can actually impact on the analysis of what you do in the case of child estrangement. What the people who are doing a lot of really groundbreaking research in this area are all coming down on the side of if you just leave it alone and just hope that it will resolve with time, one, they rarely happen, and two, may not happen till the child is well into their 20s or even 30s. And there's fundamental damage that occurs when you've alienated yourself from half of your being, half of your genetic makeup, half of your history. And even the studies done with kids who have, as young adults, reached out to try and reestablish a relationship, they're all fundamentally damaged people. So, you know, a lot of education needs to continue to be done to deal with these intractable situations. And the system itself, the family law system, is contributing to this. It's too slow. It's too ponderous. Courts don't take their own court orders seriously enough. So that there, we have our share of breakthrough decisions where you get some really insightful analysis that we just can't allow this. But quite often that happens years into the process, by which time the children's positions are fixed and there's so much bad blood due to the breakdown in access that it makes repairing it that much more difficult. So the answer, quite simply, is immediate intervention, one judge per family that stays with that family till everything gets fixed, a zero-tolerance policy for noncompliance with court orders. Not, you know, the excuses you hear, you wonder how any court has ever accepted it. I can't make them go. I've encouraged them to go. I don't stop them from going. Well, none of those are sufficient. You're the co-parent. You're required to foster and maintain and require the other relationship as well. And you're the only one who can do it because you're the one who the child's living with right now because they're not going to see the other parent. And then there's an over-reliance on therapies if it's some magic bullet. But in these cases where in a two-week period, if you do the math, child spends 340-something hours with the aligned parent and 2 to 4 hours with the therapist. So what chance does the therapist have when the child's going right back into the same environment that has permitted and fostered and in some cases caused the estrangement in the first place? Therapist doesn't stand a chance. And so in cases of moderate to severe alienation, the results of therapy are quite poor. So there really is only one answer, and that is court order is a court order. Get the child there, support the relationship, put some limits on the child's behavior, and back off and let the child experience caregiving from the estranged parent. After a while, they soften because they're going to be there for quite some time. And as soon as the children get the feeling that they've been released from the loyalty bind that they find themselves in, they usually just open up as just naturally without any massive therapeutic involvement. So not saying that therapists aren't helpful to deal with singular issues, but they're not the magic bullet. They're not going to achieve some epiphany that isn't going to be achieved just by the parents themselves. Problem is, usually you have one parent who's quite happy with the situation, and you got to tackle that parent. That's what parental alienation is all about.
And how do you tackle that parent?
It's tough because the type of person who would foster and or permit an estrangement of the child from a formerly bonded parent, it's usually hard to reach them. They're not amenable to education. They're not amenable to moral pleas. They're not amenable to scare tactics in the sense of read this. This is what's going to happen to your child. Look at all these studies. They're all damaged children. Because most of them are true believers in the sense that the estranged parent is not a good parent and that they themselves are such a good parent that the child doesn't need the other parent to thrive. So they're true believers on those points. And you put a parent like that into the overall reunification therapy process, they just use the process as yet another form to justify their view of why the children are correct in distancing themselves from the other parent. So they're quite intractable, and therefore the only thing that really works is to offer them some consequences that are worse to them than their concept of the child actually having a relationship with the other parent. And so it's the usual stuff, you know, contempt of court orders and increasingly monetary remedies. You know, if it's taken the estranged parent $100,000, $150,000 to get to the trial, and they successfully demonstrate that they were undermined, pay the $150,000, pay your own lawyer's costs, then see how you feel about not fostering a relationship with the other parent. Usually they don't want to go through that twice. Then the decision gets reported. Lawyers for aligned parents have to inform them that, one, a court order is a court order, and lawyers have to assist in enforcing court orders, and two, if it goes that way, they could be responsible for some significant costs. And so if we had more and more and more of those decisions, the word would get around that courts are no longer going to tolerate these excuses for the children not coming. And the jurisprudence is there. Why it seems not to be applied more broadly, I don't know. It's a tough area just because most people don't really fully understand it. What the aligned parents and their counsel often try and do is just clutter it. Say, well, you know, both parents are at fault. Both parents contributed to this, as if both contributed equally. And there is a response to that. No parent's perfect. No parent is going to, every single day, they're going to have the insight and the emotional balance of a child psychologist. They're always going to say the right thing. They're always going to do the right thing. They're always going to be there and not busy at work. That it's an impossible standard. So every targeted parent, and for that matter, every aligned parent, is not a perfect parent. They're all people. As long as their behavior is within the bounds of acceptable norms, it shouldn't be a matter of desperate search for some fault with the estranged parents. You could say, aha, see, both parents are at fault. Because the stuff you're going to find didn't cause the estrangement. Alienated kids treat the estranged parent horribly, and the extended family of the estranged parent. So the diagnostic tools are there to separate the wheat from the chaff, but most people don't understand it well enough. You know, we need more training of the judiciary, more training of the mental health community, more training of the family law bar, so that people can understand these fundamental precepts. It's actually pretty easy to figure out a case of whatever you want to call it, improper child manipulation or poisoning a child against the other parent, whatever you want to call it. You know, we don't need a label. We're talking about a human condition that's been around forever. You know, we have solid social science and mental health research that we know kids do better when they come out of a divorce with healthy relationships with both parents. So the system needs to be structured so that's achieved at all costs and fast. And when we see it going off the rails, we need to intervene fast and hard, because when these situations set in, they get worse and they get more difficult to solve as time goes on.
What would you suggest? How many cases, like what percentage are we talking in cases here?
It's hard. I don't think there's any definitive studies. There are some broad-based studies that have tried to make some estimates, but I don't know that those statistics are universally accepted, but it's way more common than people think. There was a broad-based study done by the American Bar Association about 10 years ago. It might be something that 20% of all cases are what we call these real high conflict cases, and maybe half of those have some noticeable measure of child estrangement. So if those numbers hold up, then that's 10% of all cases where you're seeing some very unhealthy reaction in the child, usually because they're put in the middle. They know that one parent is not supportive of the other parent's relationship, and the stress of going back and forth it becomes too much for the child, and then they wind up with an unhealthy alliance, usually with the more powerful parent. There's a psychological dynamic called identification with the aggressor. So the child splits and aligns with the more aggressive parent, who they're actually afraid of, and distances themselves from the parent from whom they feel the most unconditional love. And what they're doing subconsciously is betting that the parent they're rejecting will nonetheless be there for them and won't give up, because they feel unconditional love. So they wind up distancing themselves from the healthier of the two parents. And these children wind up being manipulated. They lie because they're being forced to lie. They make things up because they see how it pleases the aligned parent, who only wants to hear bad. So imagine a scenario where a child actually enjoys their time with the estranged parent. They feel like a traitor. They go over there. They're all wound up. It takes them a day to kind of just wind down and decompress. then they enjoy their time. Then they have to build back up because they know what's coming when they go back to the other house. They're going to get grilled. What did you do? What did you eat? And they're fishing for the negativity. So the child can't say, oh, we went to the ball game, we had so much fun, we went to the museum, it was great, because the child knows that's not what they want to hear. So instead the child will say, oh, I don't know, they left me alone, I was bored, I was just sitting around. And then what happens? So then that parent writes their lawyer and says, see what I mean? Even when the child's over there, he doesn't spend any time with the child. And, you know, that's why the child shouldn't even be going. And then you get all these letters about justified estrangement. And so it's a very complicated dynamic. It takes a lot of study and a lot of cases to really, then you start to see the overlap and the commonality and the typical indicia. So when I get calls from people now and they start telling me their story, it's just, I'm instantly relating it to 20 other cases that I've had. Heard that one before, that one before. You know, everybody's got some new twist on something that you then write down and say, okay, that's cute. That's an interesting part of the repertoire. But invariably, a year later, you hear that again in another case. So we know how to diagnose these cases, and we're just not handling it well. Too slow, too late, not a forceful enough intervention right up front.
And too much money.
Well, that's the other thing, is that the longer it goes on, and quite often, of course, they're looking just to outlast the other parent, not just financially, but emotionally, and the frustration. You know, your parents are out there, they've got court orders, and the other parent and the kids are not complying with the court orders, and there's nothing you can do about it. You go to court, there's procedural delays, or procedural impediments, or it's all, you know, on intramotions, it's just done on paper, so affidavits come back, and they're filled with lies going the other way, and the judge doesn't know what to do with it. So you go off, do a custody access assessment, and that takes 9 to 10 months. Meanwhile, the estrangement is ongoing, and there isn't compliance with the court order. What you need is the system to say, unless and until you get the Children's Aid Society in here saying child's at risk, then there is no such thing as an acceptable excuse. Court order is a court order, comply. I don't care if the child's bored or not. Send the child with some games, or send the other parents some suggestions of what to do, or suggest some counseling or some whatever, but the child goes, period. No excuses. If courts did that, you know, I'm sorry, sir, I'm sorry, ma'am, if you haven't been able to convince the Children's Aid Society to intervene here, produce the child. We would have way fewer of these cases if it was zero tolerance, in the same way that we have zero tolerance for non-payment of child support. The Family Responsibility Office can jail you, take your driver's license away. So why aren't we doing that with what is arguably even more important?
I was going to say that's more important than the money.
Yeah, help the child to survive the parent's divorce, which shakes up their whole fundamental world, their whole security. Help them by saying you are entitled to your relationship with both parents, and you're going no matter what. So get used to it and don't accept any pressure or anything from the other parent. You're going, period. So if we took the choice out of it, it would really help. Then you have a further problem, which is we have a system. Ontario has the largest government-funded system for child representation, in other words, lawyers for children, I believe in North America. So at the drop of a hat in Ontario, we're giving kids their own lawyer. So that, suppose their voice is heard. And so that leads, in these alienation cases, to a massive over-empowerment, where the child, in effect, says to the estranged parent, don't talk to me, talk to my lawyer. And it almost makes, not quite, but almost makes the child a party to his or her own parents' divorce, giving them a seat at the table in their own parents' divorce. I mean, that is intensely harmful, forcing the child to position themselves and assert a position in the proceedings and be consulted by their lawyer as to what position to take and what to assert, to bring a motion. It's ridiculous. It's intensely harmful in these cases. There's much better ways to get the so-called voice of the child before the court. And in alienation cases, the parent is just out there trying to manipulate the child in the first place, which again puts the child in the middle, because that's what happens inevitably in these cases. Is the child's being manipulated.
They're just saying whatever they're
saying. They're just saying whatever they're expected to say. And in the worst of all cases, you get false allegations of sexual abuse, that people would actually do that. Sit a child down at the kitchen table, practice their lines. And then, you know, you go tell your teacher this and that, to kind of hide where it's coming from. These types of parents use children as pawns. They're their property to deal with as they see fit, regardless, because they don't see the harm to the child. Many of them, as I said, are true believers. The child's better off without the other parent in their life.
So besides the court system, is there anything that the targeted parent can do?
We work very closely with the targeted parents because of the stresses they're under. And when you're under stress, the emotional devastation of losing a child, but you can't grieve because the child's still alive, still there. It's been stated to be worse than losing a child to death because of that very fact, that the child's still there, won't talk to you, won't return a call, calls you by your first name, changes their last name, says they now have a new mother. These children behave cruelly and despicably toward the targeted parent. A targeted parent faced with a disrespectful, omnipotent, cruel child needs a lot of help. You can't counter-retaliate. You must maintain your composure at all times. You must salve your own hurt and not try and impose a big guilt trip on the child who's caught in the middle. You must just patiently, quietly message the hope, but focus on the future, that a way can be found to recapture what once was. And, of course, the child is denying that there ever was a good relationship and will deny having gone on trips and deny that parent having taken them to years of ballet lessons or years of hockey. The whole past gets rewritten. So this, the burden on the targeted parent is nothing can prepare a parent for going through one of these files. And you're under the microscope, and every slip-up you make gets thrown back at you. See, you're partially the cause for your child's own estrangement. No, the estrangement came first. And no, yes, occasionally parents lose it and yell at their child. That doesn't lead to child estrangement. There'd be an awful lot of intact families where the child disowned the parent. We seem to impose different standards on targeted parents than we do parents in intact homes. It's an impossible burden, and their whole world is shattered. They lose friends, you know, they're preoccupied. Quite often the alienating parent is bad-mouthing them all through the town, right, with the goal of isolating them. I have an expression that parental alienation is a disease meant to be suffered in silence. They try and cut off all your supports.
Welcome back. Thank you, Brian, for your words there. I just want to touch a little bit on the CAS perspective here, is that we don't typically get involved in child and custody access matters until children start showing behavior problems like high anxiety and, they're getting in trouble all the time, they're starting to have mental health issues. So that's when we start getting involved, and that is definitely emotional abuse then when one parent is doing this to another and the child is paying the price for that.
How does Children's Aid determine these alienation cases?
We do by when we do investigation on the case, when we talk to all the family members and the children, and we start to put the pieces together.
Wonderful. So, I mean, the biggest part of alienation, as I was doing the research on this, was that kids are downright cruel to alienated parents. And, I mean, even when you look at abused children, they typically aren't cruel to the abusive parent. So that's one of the flags that seems to show up in these cases, is that these cases, the kids are even more angry and venomous to their parent than a child who's being abused by their parent physically. Yes, sometimes.
Well, it is. And we get calls from other people involved with that family, like schools and stuff like that, or churches, because the child's behavior not only changes towards that other parent, but also changes out in society when they're dealing with regular people, because their behavior is changing, right? They're becoming aggressive, and they're becoming outspoken. They're swearing out in public now. And so we are getting calls about that family.
Yeah. That didn't happen in my case, but I mean, in my case, we had my children started reacting completely different towards me, but their marks. Well, I mean, my son's marks dropped, and there was a serious drop in marks, but that was just attributed to the conflict mm-hmm. between parents, and it wasn't actually taken to, you know, parent alienation. So, I mean, it's a tough one to call, but you know, kids are at risk with this stuff, and it's huge emotional abuse.
Well, it is, and like Brian said, the parent won't even go farther and accuse the other parent of sexual abuse or something like that. So definitely we're involved in that. So yeah, there is definitely things like that happening.
Children's Aid eventually saved my family. I ended up with a really good caseworker that laid the law down with my ex, and you know, they were there every week, got involved and saved my family. So you know, we don't want to paint Children's Aid as all bad, because you know, I have to credit them with saving my family.
I'm glad to hear that. So I just wanted to go through a couple of things that I would suggest to parents that are in this situation is don't allow your children or your ex to dictate the terms of your contact with them. Wait patiently for a little bit, but don't wait too long until you feel the time is right. Alienated parents learn too late that the time is never right. And engage in conflict-free, pleasurable interaction with your children. And don't badmouth your ex with the children. And when you're trying to talk to the children about their feelings, yet their feelings are they're really real. So don't say, you know what, this is your mom saying all this. You have to say, validate their feelings. It's really important.
Wonderful. Well, this has been Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM, a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after. Thank you very much to our guests today, Mike Murphy, Natalie Murray, and Brian Ludmer. Without you guys, we couldn't have a show. Everybody else out there, we will see you in 2 weeks. I'm Michelle Boyce.
I'm Devil Hamza.
And catch us on our blogs at betweenthemargins.ca. And catch Mike's blog at parentalienationcanada.blogspot.com. So everybody out there, hopefully you're having your happily ever after, however that may look to you.